the secrets of the spiritual wayfaring, which is really another name for the servitude of Allah, the ubudiyyah of Allah. Now, this spiritual wayfaring is a journey which every single one of us has to take in our lives. Of course, it is a spiritual journey that we have to take if we want to become near Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if we want to attain the qurb, the nearness of Allah. So the salik, which is the Arabic word for the person who is conducting this spiritual wayfaring, the spiritual wayfarer, the salik, that is moving towards Allah, has to recognize their state of humility and place that humility of servitude and the glory of the lordship, the rububiyyah of Allah, before their eyes. Now, again, as we've talked in previous programs, humility, humbleness, this down-to-earth persona that a human being has is what helps one to excel in this spiritual wayfaring, in this attaining nearness to their Creator, to Allah. Now, the stronger this viewpoint is, the stronger this concept is within a human being, this state of humility and the humility of servitude is considered, the more spiritual their worship becomes and the stronger the spirit of their worship is. So humility, again, for a spiritual wayfarer is an integral and most important part of their process of spiritual wayfaring. Now, of course, if one continues in this spiritual wayfaring, the more spiritual their worship becomes, then the stronger the spirit of their worship becomes, until, with the help of Allah and the awliya of Allah, the close ones to Allah, a person reaches the truth of servitude and its core, meaning a person will witness a glimpse of the secrets of worship, the secrets of servitude, and the secrets of ubudiyyah. Invite you to listen to Sheikh Nami Farhat Al-Amali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A lot of youth are turning to religion, but some of them become very extreme. They start interpreting verses and narrations and coming up with their own theories that are not based on any solid evidence, but rather on the weak understanding of religion. And the moment you disagree with them, they start attacking you. This is a problem, but it is never too late to change. What you need to do before you start memorizing information is to work on your spirituality, to clean yourself through losing your ego. Reading is very important, but it's not enough. It is like you have a cup of water in front of you. You read how tasty the water is, how pure it is. Reading can give you some information about the water, but it doesn't make you taste the water. When you work on your spirituality, when you work on cleaning yourself and destroying your ego, you will get a chance to taste how pure the water is. And when this water goes down into your heart, it will remove extremism, and it will fill your heart with love to everyone. It will make you accept everyone, even those who you disagree with. It will make you open up to everyone, to love good for everyone, because religion is nothing other than love. Lose your ego to win yourself. Understand that you are nothing to receive everything. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were talking about, which was how a salik, a spiritual wayfarer, has to have this concept of humility and also has to regard the humility of servitude before them in order to truly reach the heights of servitude. Of course, the stronger a person's worship becomes, the more spiritual their servitude of Allah, their ubudiyah becomes, then the stronger the spirit of that ubudiyah and that servitude of Allah becomes as well. It's interesting, but when talking about a salik, a spiritual wayfarer, a person who is on this path and on this spiritual journey to attain the nearness of Allah and attain the qurb of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, we find that in the Holy Quran, in Surah An-Nisa, which is chapter number 4 and verse number 100, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "And whoever leaves his house migrating to Allah and His Messenger, and then death overtakes them, their reward is indeed with Allah." So here, dear friends, in this verse of the Holy Quran, we find that a person who leaves their house, right, and they are migrating towards Allah and Allah's Messenger, meaning they are moving towards Allah, they are on this spiritual journey, they are a salik, which is moving towards Allah, for the sake of Allah, on the path of Allah. And while they are in this migration towards Allah, death overtakes them, then the reward that they will receive is something which only Allah knows. And so in this spiritual wayfaring, in this road and this journey towards Allah, which is really the ultimate purpose of every single one of our lives, this migrating towards Allah, this walking the path which leads to Allah via righteous deeds and good deeds and the commandments of Islam and the commandments of humanity, one reaches this ultimate perfection. And even if they were to not reach that ultimate perfection, for death overtakes every single one of us, even if death were to overtake this individual, their reward is with Allah. So the important point is to keep trying, to keep moving towards Allah, to continue this spiritual wayfaring, and to continue our ubudiyah and our servitude of Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Welcome back, dear friends. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. In the previous two segments, dear friends, we talked about the secrets of the Salik, the spiritual wayfarer, this journey which every single one of us must take towards Allah. And we talked about the very integral and important role which humility plays in all of this. Of course, without humility, the spiritual wayfarer, the person who is on this journey towards Allah, will never reach their destination. And of course, all of these things come under the circle of ubudiyya, the servitude of Allah. We also talked about the verse from the Holy Quran, which was chapter number 4, Surah An-Nisa, verse number 100, where Allah talks about those people who leave their house migrating towards Allah and His Messenger. And then if death was to overtake them, Allah is the one who will give them their reward, meaning their reward is truly something which only Allah knows. Again, the importance of moving towards Allah in our lives. Here we talk about at the end this idea about loving the self, and one of the greatest idols which a person has is not necessarily the idols outside, but they are the idols inside. And so as long as a human being has their eyes on their own self and their imagined beauty and their imagined perfection, they will always be veiled and discarded from the absolute beauty of Allah and the pure perfection of Allah. And so we find in the words of Imam Khomeini, the esteemed, that the first condition for traveling to Allah is to leave this house of the self. He says, actually, it is the criterion for the struggle between right and wrong. And so, dear friends, every salik, every spiritual wayfarer who travels with the steps of selfishness and self-conceit and is wrapped in the veils of egotism, their suffering and their working towards this path of Allah would be in vain, and their journey would not be towards Allah, rather it would be towards their self. Again, if an individual is wrapped in the veils of selfishness and self-conceit and egotism and I-ness, then how do you or me, how does anyone expect to be able to reach Allah if they are trying to reach themselves? It's interesting, but there is this beautiful piece of poetry by the Persian poet by the name of Maulawi. And so Maulawi, he says that the mother of the idols is the idol of yourself, for those are mere snakes, but this is a dragon. And so very interesting here, he says that the mother of the idols, meaning all other idols, and then he says are mere snakes. They're small, they're relatively inconsequential. They are dangerous, just as snakes are dangerous. But then he says that the mother of all idols, the greatest of all idols, is yourself. And when compared to snakes, this idol of the self is a dragon. Huge, great, big dragon. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
IRIB. IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So we've entered into a new phase of media censorship. The Western media has a long track record of actually censoring the voice of the revolution, the voice of Iran, the voice of the Islamic Republic, the voice of people anywhere, everywhere, who speak out against the system anyway. But now we've actually entered a phase where they've seized the websites of Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam and other such channels out there. Now, this is a little bit strange. This actually shows us that the enemy is more on edge, it seems, than ever was before. The election of Sayyid Raisi may have a big part to play in this. I'd like to get your an opening thoughts on this entire thing. I think Sheikh Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is nothing new, like you pointed out in your opening statement. When we look at the track record of the Western hegemonic governments and their affiliated apparatus, right? Even, you know, I would go to a point where United Nations and other so-called international organizations, they're part of that whole strategy and that whole plan. They have been silencing the word of logic, the word of rationality, the word of tolerance, the word of exposing the evil and standing up and resisting against the evil. Mm-hmm. This is nothing new. It has been going on throughout the history, even before this electronic media existed. Right? If you look at the history, back in the day too, they would silence people from talking about and bringing up the realities of this world, right? Mm-hmm. So this is nothing new. Now, why is it happening now? Again, like you pointed out, I think the enemy, you know, they've realized that they're losing on the propagation and propaganda field as well. For instance, one of the examples, just to elaborate on this point, you look at the anti-Israel sentiment in the entire world, right? Especially the Western countries, right? Where they praised back in the day, they praised the Zionist regime, and you know, in the name of human rights and so on and so forth, and rights for Jewish people and so on and so forth. Now, if you go and talk to those people, because I've been in touch, right? 10, 15 years ago, the anti-Israel sentiment was very insignificant 15 years ago.
And it was limited to kind of clusters of activist groups,
exactly.
And Muslims,
exactly.
Some
and
Muslims.
And non-Muslims too. It was very, very contained, right? It was not the mainstream narrative. Now, fast-forwarding, especially after the social media and, you know, the officers of the software that are out there, the way they have raised the information level and the facts that they have presented and the logical discourses that they have presented, it has compelled many people out there, especially in the West. I keep saying West because I know in America, you know, when I used to read anytime there's a news report about Palestine or Israel in one of the mainstream news outlets, I used to read comments. You know, I think you all do every once in a while, you know, just to see what's going on, how are people. Well, back in the day, 15 years ago maybe, you would hardly find maybe one or two people exposing the crimes of the Zionist regime, right? Most of the people, they were, like I pointed out, they were supportive in one way or the other. But now if you go on any of these news, now the news channels have to delete those comments.
Yeah, often they'll say comments are not allowed.
Right? Why are they doing it? Because they're losing on that battlefield as well, and it has changed the perception of the people of the world, the general masses of the world.
I'm going to want to come back to this, but Sayyid Mahdi, so Sheikh Ali pointed out how previously, if you go 10, 15 years back, the negative sentiments towards Israel were lower than they are today. And we talked about how the activists and those small clusters of groups that existed back then who were pro-Palestine, they were contained back then, and now it's not so contained. Now, my question to you is, these groups obviously did a lot of propagation, they did lots of work, they created posters, they held up banners, they went to the protests, and all those kinds of things. To what extent do you feel that they have had an impact on the wider audiences out there?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's a very good point, it's a very solid point, that even a small group of people, if they are dedicated, if they remain steadfast, if they believe in their cause and their cause is a just cause, it might take a little bit of time, but surely they will overcome and they will be victorious even upon a larger host. Taking it from a very general, you know, in my own words perspective, which I put forth, but if you look at the Holy Quran, it says the same thing, right? That how many a small host has overcome a very large host. And what is the differentiating factor? It's not weapons and power and money and these kind of things. It's remaining steadfast, remaining on the correct path, being patient in the adversity, continuing to move forward, and fighting for a just cause. These small groups, you know, back in the day, were fighting a huge propaganda machinery, which was being pushed by the Zionist powers and pro-Zionist lobbies. I mean, even today, these Zionist lobbies are humongous. Mm. And the fact that they're losing this propaganda war or this war of information is really, I think, one, humiliating for them, despite
all those resources that they have at their disposal.
I mean, yeah, the resources, the amount of global leaders that are in their pockets, you know.
The government supporting them.
The central banks that these people...
The intimidation, let's not forget that as well. The intimidation, the police forces are on their side. Mm-hmm. The system is actually on their side, and yet...
And despite all this, you find that this small group of people who were standing up for the just cause of Palestine, and the cause of Palestine itself is just, just go and read the history about it, they stood up, they stayed steadfast, and you have seen that the tide has turned, and now more so than in solidarity of the Zionist state, the world is now in solidarity with the people of Palestine.
So coming back to Sheikh Ali, this idea of them having lost, essentially, the soft war, at least the previous battles, they've lost them. Are we saying that that's the main factor and cause in why they are censoring these predominantly Shia media
course,
outlets?
Of course, if you look at the enemy, they don't want the masses to, you know, wake up. Right, that's one of the agendas of the mainstream media, to keep them in slumber, keep them sleeping, you know, just be irrelevant in this whole equation of you know, truth versus falsehood and righteousness versus falsehood, the haq and batil. They want them to be just indifferent, right? Just focus on your own life, because it goes with their whole philosophy of life and the outlook they have towards the world and the life, where they say that you're a social animal who should only be concerned with your own needs and wants. You know, just stay there, and no need. While when you look at Islam, for instance, or even human logic, right? We cannot be indifferent about a person dying on the street. We cannot be indifferent about, you know, a pregnant woman not reaching the hospital. We cannot be indifferent about a neighbor who is suffering, right?
It's this just is the true human definition of a social life.
Right.
Their definition is a contradiction, as you
right.
said.
So what these media outlets, you know, especially the ones who are banned, I don't know about all of them, because I haven't really studied all of them, but at least a few I know of, which were news reporting websites and satellite channels, they are banned because due to their activities and because what they were putting out there, and they were informing people, the masses were waking up, waking up against oppression, waking up against tyranny, waking up against these control that the Western hegemonic governments have had over them for decades, if not centuries, right? They were waking up to the reality of so-called liberal democracy. You know, the last 200 years phenomena. You know, it's just like a hoax. You know, where people were made to believe that you have a say, you have a right, you have. No, you don't have right, you don't have say, you don't have freedom of expression, you don't have freedom of speech in the West. You look at the academics who were not even Muslims, right? In some cases, they were Jewish people, right? These academics, their careers were ruined because they exposed the Western treachery and their plots, and especially the evil nature of the Zionist regime of Israel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their academic careers were destroyed. Well, he's a teacher, he's a professor, right? Norman Finkelstein, for instance, you
mm-hmm,
know,
mm-hmm.
So on and so forth. There are too many of them, right? It's just one example.
And even people who weren't associated with the idea of Palestine, so to speak, but people like Julian Assange, who were just pointing out that, look, the flaws of the Western imperialistic system, even they're imprisoned.
Right. Now they're feeling vulnerable. Now the West is feeling vulnerable. They've put together something over the course of last 200 years, which is called the liberal democracy and its affiliated apparatus. They're feeling that it's vulnerable. People are not going to get tricked into and take it as at its face value. People are standing up, challenging that system, right? You saw, like, even with the so-called democracy, how people opposed the elected government and the Trump era and the transition to Biden. You saw that, right?
Fiasco. The storming of the Capitol is a huge historical event.
Right? So now they're seeing that we are weak. They're seeing that the masses are waking up. They're seeing that it is not that we can just put out a multi-million dollar news reporting website or a TV channel or a satellite channel and the masses will be fooled that easily.
Or even that the movies that they make are going to completely, put out their propaganda. Exactly. You know, you have superhero movies presenting the American military as the good guys and stuff. Right. So
now
people are even waking up to the cracks
now
in that.
The question is, connecting it back to your question, with all this in mind, who made it all happen? How did the masses wake up? It is because of projects like Press TV. It is because of projects like Al-Alam. It is because of projects like Al-Masira, right? These are the projects which are run by human beings, not by robots. Like, their setups are being run by, you know, the machine-built artificial intelligence-based censorship and all that. No, these are human beings who are interacting with other people. And when that sentiment gets put out there in form of news, it has an effect on people. And because they were being effective in exposing the plots of the tyrants and the oppressive governments, they are silenced. Because that's all the West can do. They just know how to silence others, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Sometimes countries, sometimes governments, sometimes media channels, sometimes. Look at the crackdown that happened on social media profiles right after the martyrdom of Shahid Qasem Soleimani,
mm-hmm.
right? People who had established profiles, 10 years, 12 years old profiles, they were wiped off their platforms.
Yes.
From Facebook, from Twitter, from YouTube, from Instagram, you know, so on and so forth. Now what we're seeing, this recent wave, is targeting those channels which are on satellite. So when it comes to social media, many of these channels of spreading the truth, they were removed. Now it's the turn of the satellite channels, Press TV and Al-Masira and Al-Alam and all that.
That's all we have time for, unfortunately. A fascinating discussion, inshallah, which we will be continuing, inshallah, next time. From myself and from our honorable guests, we bid you assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. You can log on to our website at parstoday.com, and you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, goodbye.
A symphony of nature. Oh, it's taking my breath away. I'm so blessed out here today, yeah. Allah, 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 Allah. I see the sun, the stars.
aperture.
A visit to Iran yields a stunning variety of culinary delights. There is a vast spectrum of foods flourishing for centuries and evolving since Achaemenid times. Persian cooking incorporates many flavors into its uniquely delicious food traditions. A taste of Persia's food can be identified by its sumptuous rice dishes, its intriguing and delicate flavors, and its combination of herbs, spice, fruit, and nuts. And one integral component to Persian cuisine is the use of saffron, the world's most expensive spice, which gives Iranian food its distinct flavor and aroma and golden hue. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Many coveted ingredients are native to Iran, including pistachios, almonds, walnuts, pomegranates, grapes, and perhaps most notably, saffron. Iran has a variable climate with four distinct seasons. The ancient Persians transformed vast stretches of arid land into fertile oases through underground aquifers that drew melted snow water into the desert. And thus, a bright, sensuous, fruit and herb-filled cuisine was born. This week on Aperture, we will follow Javad Gharayi as he explores the amazing deserts of South Khorasan province and visits a charming little village where saffron, the world's most highly prized spice, is grown. Don't miss the first part.
This time, I leave the cold winter weather in the capital city for the beautiful desert flower farms. My destination is the outskirts of South Khorasan province, an area famous for its saffron, Iran's prized red gold. Iran is one of the most mountainous countries in the world, covered by rugged mountain ranges and deserts. 61% of the country has a dry climate. Deserts cover a combined area of around 34 million hectares, scattered among 18 of its provinces. That means around 30% of the country is made up of vast deserts featuring many mountains, salt pans, and sand dunes. Deserts across the world share almost the same features: little precipitation, intense evaporation of water due to the scorching sun, smothering heat, dry air, great temperature fluctuations, poor vegetation, and a dearth of adequate organic compounds in the soil. However, despite the hostile climate of the deserts of Iran, life is in progress on their margins. I'm Javad Gharayi. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and showing you their many beauties. Before visiting the saffron grove, I decide to take a look around at the desert surroundings on the outskirts of South Khorasan province. To that end, I begin my journey with Halwan Desert, located within 90 kilometers of Tabas, a city in and the capital of Tabas County, in the northwest of South Khorasan. Because of its distance from the urban areas, the natural beauties of deserts are not known to humans as much as they should. If you want to venture out into the desert in order to admire its matchless beauties, you'd have to choose the right season and the right time of day. From a distance, deserts and the wilderness don't seem all that beautiful. Once you've set foot in them, you feel as if you've stepped into a veritable heaven. but a different kind of heaven. You don't see forests with tall trees, grass, or running water. All you can see is streams with very salty water, single salt cedars and saxholes, scattered shrubs and bushes in the landscape, camels and other species unique to this hot and dry climate. It's very beautiful and peaceful here, but that's not always the case. Within minutes, this whole area can turn into an ominously stormy ocean. Ferocious storms of sand and dust that have buried many a caravan and traveler over the course of centuries. In the not-too-distant past, some of Iran's deserts were inhabited by people living in this climate. But thanks to global warming and decreased precipitation that led to drinking water wells drying and parts of the vegetation dying, the people living in such areas were forced to leave their little villages for a better place. Today, those villages lay in ruins on their original locations, ruins that now serve as shelters for the camel herders against the blazing sun. But these homes of yesterday are still as beautiful as ever. Deserts around the world are expanding by the year. Desert expansion or desertification is a result of global warming, the growth in the human population, unplanned agriculture and excessive firewood collection, depletion of subterranean water resources, industrial contaminants and excessive use of fossil fuels, overgrazing by livestock, and the change in the use of agricultural land. This conversion of habitable and fertile land to uninhabitable desert can happen naturally due to a drought, or can be caused by human activities. Activities that have disturbed the balance of nature on planet Earth. Iran accounts for more than 2% of the world's drought. It's also home to more than 8% of the deserts and arid lands that contain no vegetation, and that is considered a big number. But in the fringes of this same hot and dry desert, meaning the one in South Khorasan, there are mountains that supply the rivers and qanats in this area with drinking water. Streams that could be regarded as the natural wonders of this otherwise parched region. Taht-e-Arus, or the bride's throne, near the village of Izmiran on the Tabas-Mashhad road, is a befitting name for this stream. The flowing water reminds me of the celebrations held by people in the old times upon the discovery of clean, fresh water in a hot and dry region. Only those born and bred in a dry climate with limited resources of fresh water appreciate its true value. People who have endured thirst, have felt the baking heat from the sun on their skin, and may have seen rain coming down from the skies over their heads only once a year. The people of Izmiran fit that profile perfectly. God has bestowed upon them fresh water in a stream gushing out of the dry desert mountains around Tebas. And the people here have utmost appreciation for this most precious of God's blessings in the heart of the natural world. In the distant past, the people of Izmiran lived in dwellings carved into mountain wall. With the tools they had, they would dig deep vertical and horizontal holes into the side of the mountains. In them, they'd carve out rooms where they'd live. In the past, these hand-carved chambers were referred to as looms. desert people are very smart. Using the water from the stream and the fertile soil here, they've been farming rice for generations. Today, the rice produced in Esmiran is among the best in the country. Who would believe there are paddy fields in the middle of a desert and among these mountains? Everybody thinks rice is only grown in the north of Iran. But where does the stream go on this dry land after irrigating the paddy fields of Esmiran? Does it sink into the arid terrain in the areas surrounding the rice farms? That can't be the case, because to the desert dwellers, fresh water is worth more than diamonds. The locals in this area have spoken to me of a formidable yet beautiful canyon and helped me see the rest of the course that the water from Tahtiaru spring takes. The name of that canyon is Kali Jinni, the Canal of Jinns, shaped by water movement and erosion over centuries. I'm going to step into a canyon where the water from Tahtiaru spring is flowing, but the volume of the water is not large enough to make it to the end of this very long course without going to waste. I'm curious to know how that water continues on its path in the dry land and where it eventually gets to. It's simply beautiful. As I said, the name of the awe-inspiring canyon is Kali Jinni. On its bottom, water from the Tahtiaru spring of Tabaz is moving as we speak. Most of the way, the water flows between the two walls of this canyon, just like it does in Aghanat, and springs out of the underground near Tabaz. It's one of the most beautiful sights to see around the city of Tabaz in South Khorasan province. The Canal of Jinns. That's a scary name. Kali Jinni was shaped so beautifully by water movements, such as seasonal rain-induced floodwaters over thousands or millions of years. It kind of looks like the Grand Canyon in the U.S., though it doesn't share the same depth. It really is stunning. After a long walk in the mountains, I arrive at the upper end of the canyon. From up here, it's a spectacular deep gorge. I explore the canyon as much as I can, and as long as there is nothing to threaten my life. But as I walk the length of it, water from Tahtiaru spring is nowhere to be found most of the way. The locals have already given me valuable information about that, but to see everything firsthand, I have to walk down to the bottom of the valley, and I do so with gusto and caution. One of the things that renders Kali Jinni even more remarkable is its pristineness. Not many nature travelers come here, and fortunately those who do don't leave behind any kind of waste or garbage. And that has turned this canyon into one of the most must-see natural sites in the Tabaz area. There are ghanats here. In some places, water has pushed its way out, but there are still other ghanats inside walls that continue all the way to the villages of Tabaz. And this water originates from the Tahtiaru spring in Esmiran province. It's the same water that's come all the way here and has welled out. In the absence of plumbing in the past, they would channel fresh water from one village to another or from the mountains to their villages and farms by means of a canal system, and they did it to prevent the water from going to waste. This one here is one of those ghanats. Out on the bottom of the canyon, the water would sink into the ground. So they channeled the water downhill through a series of gently sloping tunnels along several kilometers to the places where it was needed for irrigation and domestic use. Although new ghanats are seldom built today, many old ones are still used in Iran, and have until recently served as one of the main reasons behind the continuation of life in areas with hot and dry climates. New technology has in recent years led to a rapid depletion of the underground water reservoirs, but we can still think of reviving the Ghanat water supply system, take advantage of this millennia-old experience for agricultural purposes in Iran, and do something to make it happen. I knew very well that the rainfall in the eastern regions of the country is less than half the rain that falls in the western regions. Therefore, water is much more valuable in this part of the country. The people living in these parts have always been thinking of innovative ways of harnessing water and managing its resources. Digging ganats and channeling underground water onto the surface was very common in Iran. They didn't cost much, and they were very efficient. Ganats offered several advantages. Firstly, they prevent the sun from shining directly at the water and making it evaporate. Secondly, moving inside the mountains, not much of the water is absorbed by the bedding walls of the channel. And thirdly, the water is immune to any and all kinds of contamination and flows to its destination clean and cool. What's certain is that humans wouldn't have been able to survive in the desert areas if they hadn't built the ganats. Almost all researchers believe that the world's first ganats were built in areas under Iran's cultural influence. No one knows for sure why the ancient dwellers of this region named this gorge the Kali Jinni, but apparently some of them believe this canyon was haunted by jinns or ghosts. There were others who believed the idea of digging holes and caves into the mountainside for safety was something that even ghosts wouldn't have been able to come up with. Or maybe the reason why this canyon was named the Canal of Jinns was the roaring seasonal floodwaters that swept along this canyon and still do today. Whatever the name, it must have been chosen for a reason. It defies belief that there is so much water in the Kali Jinni Canyon. To the people of southern Khorasan province, each drop of this water is worth as much as a kilo of saffron, and this canyon has a lot of it. It looks like someone has chiseled away at the rocks. The only sound you can hear in the mountains is that of the water rippling along the ganats. Eventually, I get to a point in the canyon where the ancient dwellers of this land redirected the water from the surface to a canal inside the mountain. This is where the water is redirected underground. It was the brainchild of folks who lived here in the distant past, and that beautiful ganat dug inside the wall of the canyon carries this water to the villages lying on the outskirts of Tabas. The locals have told me different things about the cavities and man-made holes inside the Kali Jinni. Apparently, no one has accurate information on the age of those cave-like shelters. But tales of how they came to be have been passed down from one generation to another. I spend hours scouring the canyon for those man-made tunnels, and I finally find them. It is hard to believe how these tunnels were hand-carved at this height. Niches that acted as footholds to help them climb some 5 or 6 meters to get to the chambers above, where they are likely to have lived. And that was where they felt safe. It's still not clear why these tunnels, these wells, and these chambers were dug into the walls of this canyon and at this height by the people in the past. But many believe they actually lived here. This was the perfect place for people to take shelter in and survive the stifling heat of the Tabas region. And there are many others who believe this was a place where the village dwellers around here, who wanted to steer clear of the brigands and looters, would transfer all their valuable belongings. They themselves would hide here too, along with their belongings, and wait for the looters to leave the area. Of course, there are also others who are of the opinion that these tunnels were just the right place for the people of that time to come to and worship their gods. That in fact, they considered this place as their place of worship. They call it the Canal of Jinns for a reason. It can get really scary in some parts. And it's obvious that torrential floodwaters have shaped this valley like this over the years. In fact, what those floodwaters did was wash away the dirt and stones on their path. Of course, it might have taken millions of years for this canyon to take on the shape it has today. It's frightening to be here and walking on the bottom flanked by tall walls. It looks endless to me. I've been walking these smaller gorges near Kalajini for hours, but it looks like there is no end in sight. I haven't been able to get to the other end of any of them. The deeper you go inside, you realize you have more to go. This is a completely virgin valley with no traces whatsoever of human activity in it. Usually, garbage is the first sign of human presence in the natural world. It's clear to me that only people who feel responsible to nature have been to this area before. That is because there is no trash on the ground and no writings on the walls. That has made my trip into the heart of the canyon ever more worthwhile and helped me appreciate its magnificence more intensely. My visit to the Kalajini Canyon has come to an end. I got to see beautiful sights in the canyon from different angles. The canyon has a scary name, but that didn't change my mind about traveling right into it and exploring it. I continue my trek in the desert, this time to see the desert flower, commonly known as the saffron crocus. That means an approximately 200-kilometer walking distance from the Kalajini Canyon. On my way there, the imposing ruins of an ancient building grab my attention. They are the remains of a desolate village by the name of Dihuk. Iranian deserts always have wonderful surprises for travelers, and this beautiful ancient village is one of them. What really tugs at my heartstrings, though, is that the villagers have abandoned these buildings with their unique architecture for brick-and-mortar homes. It saddens me to see traditional Iranian architecture consigned to oblivion by my fellow Iranians in cities and villages. Today, Iranian architecture that encompasses life and vitality, art and aesthetic beauties, and love and positive energy is being replaced by ghastly steel and mortar structures. Architecture that's alien to the Persian culture. Architecture that bears no signs of the ancient Persian culture and doesn't include the freshness, the gardens, the water pools, and other natural features characteristic of traditional Persian architecture. Such homes do not belong in our country, and I wish they'd never been built. In my opinion, this ancient village is one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in this area. The people here, I mean the people who used to live here, call this village Ancient Dihuk. Now, they live in a small township by the same name, built around 20 to 25 years ago. It was built after the earthquake in the year 1978. So now they call this place Old Dihuk, which, as I say, is one of the most beautiful villages on the margins of the Lut Desert.
Limelight. Former U.S. President Donald Trump blasted Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, for not using his weapon against Democrats and agreeing to a deal on the debt ceiling. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Ayla Slisko, writing for Newsweek magazine. The piece is titled, "Trump condemns debt ceiling deal, says McConnell had the weapon and was unable to use it." Former U.S. President Donald Trump blasted Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, for not using his weapon against Democrats and agreeing to a deal on the debt ceiling. Mitch McConnell had previously opposed the deal but shifted his position on Wednesday, 6th of October, announcing that Republicans would not block a Democratic attempt to pass a temporary fix. The standalone debt ceiling bill passed along party lines on Thursday, 7th of October, after 10 Republicans joined Mitch McConnell to break a GOP filibuster. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell insisted he had stepped forward with a plan to prevent a debt default. Donald Trump denounced the minority leader's decision and called for new leadership among Senate Republicans during a Thursday night interview on Fox News Channel's Hannity. "The Republican Senate needs new leadership," Donald Trump said. "I've been saying it for a long time. Mitch McConnell is not the guy. He's not the right guy. He's not doing his job. He gave them a lifeline. It's more than a lifeline. He gave them so much time now to figure out what to do because they were in a real bind, a real big bind. They wouldn't have been able to do anything. He had the weapon and he was unable to use it," added Donald Trump. "And it's a shame, it's a shame. These 11 people, I know them. Some are wonderful and some I don't agree with too often. You know, I'm not surprised to see some of the names. But I will tell you that this was not a good thing that happened today. He made a big mistake." Earlier in the day, Donald Trump issued a statement urging Republican senators to not vote for this terrible deal being pushed by folding Mitch McConnell. Although 10 senators did join Mitch McConnell, no Republicans voted in favor of the bill itself, which temporarily increases the debt limit until December and did not require GOP votes to pass. Newsweek has reached out to Mitch McConnell's office for comment. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, delivered a speech blasting Republicans for partisan brinkmanship just after the 11 GOP senators joined with Democrats to end debate on the bill and allow the vote to move forward. "Republicans played a dangerous and risky partisan game, and I'm glad that their brinkmanship did not work," Senator Chuck Schumer said. He added, "For the good of American families, for the good of our economy, Republicans must recognize in the future that they should approach fixing the debt limit in a bipartisan way." Leader Mitch McConnell and Senate Republicans insisted they wanted a solution to the debt ceiling, but said Democrats must raise it alone by going through a drawn-out, convoluted, and risky reconciliation process, he added. "That was simply unacceptable to my caucus." And yesterday, Senate Republicans finally realized that their obstruction was not going to work. Senator Chuck Schumer's speech reportedly infuriated a number of Republicans who had allowed the vote to move forward. It also rankled Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, who told reporters that he didn't think it was appropriate at this time.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.